for another episode of Occam's Razor, a podcast about the unexplained. Brought to you on Podcast Radio with your host, Jim Bedchill.
Welcome to Occam's Razor. I'm Jim Bedchill. As I often do, apologize for not producing a lot of content in recent times. There is an excuse, though, for that this time. I'd actually been in the UK and I was chasing up a few things that warranted investigation. One of the most intriguing cases I think I've ever come across in this, I don't know what we want to call it, the paranormal realm, the unexplained. And it's to do with a house in a small village in a county called Suffolk in the UK called Ruffham. Now, Ruffham is home to a phenomenon whereby a house, well, they call it a disappearing house, but it's more a house that appears in a field to people. And 20 eyewitnesses over the past 150 years minimum, that's recorded eyewitnesses, have seen this phenomenon. I was intrigued enough to, as part of my trip to the UK recently, to visit the area where I met up with Simon Nunn, who is a documentary filmmaker, and he has extensive knowledge of the Ruffham Mirage or Disappearing House or whatever we want to call it. So I've decided to get Simon on Occam's Razor tonight after I met up with him in the UK and we managed to get around the site. So how are you this evening, Simon? Or well, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Yeah, very well, thank you. Very well. Yeah, it's a very miserable, classical, rainy day. Yeah.
Is it kind of a pea soup look to it, or is it really coming down?
No, it's really coming down. But apparently we're going to have a final sunny spell coming, and then that's it.
Indian summer, perhaps. Well, the weather was pretty good when I was over there anyway, and I recall in Suffolk where I met you. I met you at the – we'll paint a picture for the listeners just to – well, give some background on the area of Suffolk itself. It's in the northeast of England. If you travel by London, sort of north-northeast, you'll end up in Cambridge, and then you sort of dart across a little bit further from there, and you're in a town called Bury St. Edmunds, where as we started a little adventure. Simon, I met you at the Abbey ruins in the town.
Yeah, and that's right. We met up on Angel Hill, I believe.
Angel Hill,
outside
yes.
Outside the Abbey Gate to the Abbey Gardens. Then we had a nice little jaunt around the Abbey Gardens, looking at several flower displays. And, and then we went to the graveyard that was adjoined to the Abbey,
yep.
Where a lot of monks are buried, a lot of kind of Victorian grave sites, and I think you got some really nice footage there. We went around the cathedral. And then I think we went to Moyses Hall in the centre of Bury, which is a really old museum. We went to the exhibition. I can't remember the name of it, but it had, had all the witch bottles and all the kind of supernatural elements to it, and gave a quite nice overview of the dark history of Bury, because I think I mentioned at the time that a lot of the witch trials that happened with Matthew Hopkins, I think his name was Witchfinder General, happened in Bury, and it was kind of the epicenter of a lot of the kind of torture and murder of these innocent people, I guess, accused of supernatural, acts. And apparently I think that the kind of model that Matthew Hopkins used in Bury was kind of then transferred to the Salem witch trials. You might have to check up on that, but I believe that is true.
So it was like when Americans copy a UK sitcom and do their own sort of man about the house sort of a situation, right?
Exactly like that.
they did the same with Witchfinding. That was brilliant, and I really enjoyed Barrie itself. It's one of those places you get as soon as you get there. You know, it's got some sort of energy. There's something going on in the air there, to me anyway.
I mean, they say that the ley lines cross over. I think it's St. Michael and St. Mary's cross over. I think just by the Abbey Gardens, actually. I think I don't know if that's actually true. I haven't looked into that area specifically for the ley lines, only in Ruffin. But there is some sort of atmosphere, like, I don't know, like you say, energy in the air in Barrie. It's quite a soft, quaint village.
You can feel its history, though, can't you? You can really feel the past, like you're still in touch with it. You know, it's got that, you know, for a bit of a paranormal nerd like me, I suppose, it's sort of a place where you can definitely feel, you know, people have been there for a long time. And it gives you sort of the impression that you're just one of a million billion people that have walked on the same roads over time, you know, dating back to the earlier civilizations of Britain. So, yeah, great place. And then we made our mate, your friend, nice of him to pick us up, and he took us to, well, close enough to
Ryan Jordan.
That's right, yes, Ryan, and he took us to near Ruffham. First of all, we stopped at a rather spooky church, didn't we?
Yeah, that was Bradfield's St. George's Church. So that was, I think that is literally like a mile or two away from the Grove, south of Ruffham. We had a quick look around there. You kind of got a bit scared, I think. I think that was your first experience in a kind of remote church, because it does look like something straight out of a horror film.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, it'd actually be a great setting for one if someone was to... Yeah, and they had that creepy river, and you know, the wind was just blowing just enough to make everything a little uneasy, and it certainly set the scene with the tombstones and the long grass and that sort of carry on. So it was a great start to the trip anyway. Moving on just up the road to Ruffham, you're the man, you're the go-to in terms of discussing the phenomenon. It's not a, you know, other people have spoken and written about the phenomenon over time. As we said, there's about 200, there's about 20 reports over the past 150 years that have been documented anyway. What attracted you to the Ruffham mystery initially?
Well, I think I mentioned when I met you in Barrie that the first time I actually heard about it was I think I must have been in my early 20s or late teens at a local pub, and people were swapping like kind of ghost stories. And this chap was telling me about this one in Ruffham, about this house disappearing. And I don't know, there was something about it that's just so... extraordinary about, the idea that a house is doing the haunting, not like people haunting within a house. I mean, that's quite a strange concept.
It's certainly unique in this business, as it were.
It is. And I don't think there's many or any really cases of that. Not that I found in the UK anyway. There's obviously like the time slip phenomena that I think Carl Grove has attributed to it. And there's a lot of literature on time slips and how, people do tend to walk around grounds or, the Versailles kind of story of those two ladies.
The Mark Moberly Jourdain incident, right?
Yeah. And seeing like kind of Marie Antoinette era unfold before their eyes, and then coming out of it and being like, what the hell did I just see? I think the Ruffham, you know, it's such an allure because it's, I don't know, I just like the idea that there is like a structure out there that, there must be an explanation for it. You know, there's people are seeing it, and I don't know. It kind of just got me hooked. I just kind of want to find out what is going on.
Just briefly explain for people listening what people do see when they to set the scene of where the house is seen and what time of day and by whom and that sort of thing.
So I guess the kind of correlation between all of them is that they tend to see a red brick Georgian style house with white columns at the front.
Yeah.
Most reports are during the day. I'd say probably morning to afternoon, but then there are a few reports there at night, which does kind of contradict the idea, I guess, of a mirage, because that usually would happen, in the hottest point of the day, I'd say. But the night mirages do exist, but they're more light phenomena, not like seeing a building clear as day kind of thing. But yeah, so it's a red brick Georgian style mansion, white columns at the front. People even, there was one lady who could name the kind of type of roses and color of the roses in the front garden. Iron pearly gates surrounding this house. There was even one lady who said that she saw a little girl in the window, which she is the only person, I think, that has claimed to have seen somebody in the house. Most people just see it as an empty house. Windows glowing. I think there was that lady that you spoke with, the academic.
That's right. I was going to come to that later.
But yeah, we'll bring that up later. But that's the kind of picture, is this red brick Georgian house in this field.
Mm.
Large windows.
And the phenomenon is so well documented that there's actually a whole file of newspaper clippings kept at the Bury St. Edmunds sort of records office, mm-hmm. isn't there? It's pretty well known local legend that just a lot of people seem to have it's most bizarre thing I've heard for some time. I mean, and that's what fascinated me so much about it. And obviously that's what triggered your interest in terms of making this documentary. To see a whole house appear and then not be there when people return. Is pretty phenomenal, isn't it? And the people that have reported, you and I have both spoken with and interviewed people who have seen the phenomenon or know somebody that has. And what's remarkable about it is how similar their stories are, particularly in terms of where the house is seen. It's most of the time seen on one side of the road, but it has been seen, I think, on occasion on the other side, in a really nondescript area in a small town, and it's truly bizarre. It's to paint the picture. So it's a disused field. Well, the field isn't used for crops by the looks of it currently. Anyway, correct me if I'm wrong. Behind that is a grove of trees. Which in the past had played host to, some modern druids and things like that, and people that are interested in, and I don't know, the dark arts is probably too strong a word, but certainly alternative alternative views. Let's talk about the people you've interviewed in the past and just the consistency between their stories what stood out for you, yeah.
Because, that's the strange thing, is a lot of people that you've interviewed and I've interviewed, and obviously the historical cases that exist, I think I would say 80% of the people had no idea of the phenomena beforehand, and they have no relation to each other, which is, I guess, a really important information about it, because I was thinking about this recently. Obviously, the earlier cases, I think, from a completely skeptic point of view, you could potentially brush them off, maybe, because obviously it was like, I think 1860 was the first one by a farm labourer, and maybe he did see it, but then he went and told people, and that was all done by word of mouth. So someone could have, as a laugh, said it. And then it kind of primed people, and people then started claiming that they'd seen it. But then you've got people who are driving past, you know, like 100 years later, seeing this thing, having no relation to the village or the background of the story whatsoever, and, you know, and seeing it and reporting it, and then also not reporting it. And then once someone does like a call out like you or me, they then come forward and then say, hey, actually, yeah, I did see this really beautiful Georgian style house, and I went back to look at it and it wasn't there. And people tend to not have a clue of what the actual thing is.
No,
so I think that's really important to say.
Yeah, as I said, you know, and we've had some really good word to use probably is learned people that have seen the phenomenon but don't want to court attention by appearing in your documentary. I just wanted to read out a case. We mentioned just about the academic lady, we'll call her, who is not somebody that would really court fame, would have any reason to. The way she's written her accounts and the subsequent emails I've had with her, she doesn't give me the impression of someone who would bother making up a story like this. And that's what made her one sort of resonate with me so much. So I'll just read a part of her report of the Ruffham house. She was making her way basically home. She noted a house basically on the side of the road, and she said, because I took it to be real as I had not seen it before. I saw it in darkness, and since it was clearly a large and important house, I made a mental note to myself to look it up one day in daylight. I told my husband about it on my return home, and he did not recall anything of architectural interest on that route. Some months later, we found ourselves on the same road in a summer daylight, and I looked for the house again, but there was no house, just one open field after another. I'm confident that I saw this house, so I was puzzled by our failure to find it. A couple of years later, I mentioned the incident to someone I knew who lives in the area, and they told me about the Mirage House, which I'd never heard of before. Indeed, I have never heard of any phantom building, and I was unaware of that such a phenomenon existed. And this is a classic tale, isn't it? Which is as I said, consistent with stories, you know, of people that both of us have spoken with pertaining to their account. Yeah, and this one was actually more interesting because she does mention that she appeared to be able to see some sort of she goes into so much detail that she mentions a tall deciduous hedge. So we're dealing with someone with pretty good recollection of you know events. You know, an expert eye is probably a good way to put it. And she mentioned she's age 69, agnostic. And have graduate and postgraduate qualifications and enjoyed a successful academic career. So we're not dealing with somebody who's had too many pints at the is it the Red Lion in Ruffham? What was it called? The Red?
The Bennett Arms.
The Bennett Arms. I don't know why I thought it was called the Red Lion, but close enough. At the Bennett Arms, are we? So tell us about your investigations. Obviously, you've been putting work into this documentary you're making. I understand you actually camped out in the area that known as the Grove. Was that in the hope of obviously seeing the phenomenon, picking up something unusual? And what did you find?
Potentially. So I think it was when lockdown lifted in the UK. This would have been 2020.
Yeah.
I was working at home, and then I discovered an article about, I think it was Carl's actually, on academia.
Just explain for people listening who Carl Grove is, because I think he's, you know, he's quite pertinent to this whole tale.
Definitely. So Carl Grove, I mean, if anyone's interested, I would highly recommend going on academia.org, or if you go on archive.org, you can, you know, read it for free. It's Carl Grove's report that he did on the Ruffham Mirage, what we're talking about. He attributes it to time slip, but he investigates it over a couple of years, and he details a report from interviewing local historians and different witnesses. And he visits the Grove, you know, analyzes the different types of trees, the kind of geological, you know, kind of like landscape
and features, and yeah,
I don't know exactly. So it's a detailed report, and yeah, he spent many years writing this. So it's a very detailed count. And so obviously, when I started my research, I reached out to Carl, and I think you have as well. And he has been very generous and helpful along the way. A kind of rough mirage mentor, I guess.
And he's really put in some legwork, hasn't he, Carl? I mean, it's very thorough, isn't it?
It is very thorough, and it's really entertaining and fascinating. Mm. And yeah, I'd recommend any listeners to go and read it to get a real in-depth analysis of kind of the background and what's kind of manifesting there, what's kind of happening. But yeah, I mean, my kind of research, I started with Carl, and then he directed me to another person who I have to mention is Phil Sage, who is a local kind of oral historian of Wrotham.
Right.
He helped me out a lot, and I did interview him. When I met him, he was probably about 98. He'd been in two wars. He was quite a character, just oozing with stories about Wrotham, not necessarily about the house, just like all sorts of paranormal activity that he's experienced, but also like his neighbours or people that have passed through the village over time has given him memory like a friggin' elephant, man. So sharp, and just, yeah, he had a plethora of knowledge. So yeah, after speaking with these two chaps, I went to Wrotham for basically 10 days, I think it was. I camped out at the Bennett Arms because obviously if you're gonna investigate a ghost story, you've got to go to the pub, the village pub.
Absolutely.
That's where you're gonna get the good stuff. So I spent, I think, the majority of the time at the Bennett Arms, talking with locals, trying to get some information. I mean, I heard so many anecdotes about Wrotham and about the house. I mean, a lot of people that I spoke with were just a bit like, it's just drunk people walking home claiming to see it. Which obviously it's not. But yeah, the one night I did camp out in the field, just for the hell of it, just to see. And I was there with Ryan. I think I told you this story that we went there with this kind of electronic device that he built, that apparently can communicate with the other side. He read this in a book called The Skull Experiment, which was a group of kind of paranormal experts and scientists.
Right, yeah.
Stuff like investigating consciousness beyond death. And they got instructed to build, I think it's a germanium transdimensional communicator, is what it's called.
Yep.
But Ryan built one. So yeah, we sat in the field, plugged this thing in, and it's just screeching feedback, basically. There was a signal. I don't know what it was. I've got the recording somewhere. And yeah, we were there for about an hour or so, and then we started to kind of just wander around the kind of periphery of the grove. Because, I mean, if anyone's been to a wood at night with, like, a couple of people and there's no lights about it, it's pretty scary.
Mm.
Your kind of primordial brain kind of kicks in. You're like, right, don't go in there. You don't want to be getting in there. But, yeah, we're just kind of, like, moseying about. And there's a gypsy camp to the south of the grove, and there are a few lights on there, like, obviously, like, little floodlights so people can see what they're doing. And I started to see them move about a bit, and so did Ryan, but I kind of started moving my head between the silhouettes of the trees to be like, oh, is it just from walking, are they moving about? But then I'd do that, and then they'd move the other way. And we were like, oh, okay, that's a bit weird. And I kind of like wandered off towards the road because I was like a bit freaked out. But Ryan went for a wee and said he saw more lights moving about in the forest. So... strange. And it's weird because this was before I spoke to or interviewed Phil, and he told me that a lot of locals, especially the ones in the bungalow that live opposite the forest, have seen moving lights at night in there.
It doesn't surprise me. Having been to the site and experienced the vibe, as it were, nothing surprises me. It really sets the scene as well. It's got the field full of crows and the sort of carry on as well. And it, you're a brave man spending 10 days camping out there, I put it that way. You mentioned the pub before and people sort of writing off their fellow patrons by saying, you know, they'd had too much to drink and they're just seeing things in the field. I recall you had spoke with a elderly gentleman in the pub who was initially a bit affronted but then became a source of pretty good information. Tell us about that.
So, I don't know if they're still alive or still drink there, but there was two gentlemen that would always sit by the front door. One of them is, I don't know how to relay this story because there's a lot of context to it. But basically, one of the gentlemen was quite we call him a loudmouth here. Someone who's quite opinionated and likes to talk over people. And his other friend was a bit quiet, a bit reserved. And the guy behind the bar actually told me the quiet one has actually seen the house twice. And this actually relates to a story of Jean Bartram, who was going out with her friend, putting posters up because her friend's cat had run away in the area. And they bumped into a guy walking his little Jack Russell. And Jean approached him and said, "Oh, we're right where the Ruffin Ghost House appears. Have you seen it?" And he replies, "I've only seen it twice. The first time I saw it, I thought they were building in the area." It turns out I spoke to the same guy at the pub, you know, had no idea about the kind of relation at that point. He lives on the gypsy site, and he would walk his dog every day in that field for about 15 years and claim to have seen it twice. But his friend, on the other hand, who was just like, a loud mouth, kind of just saying, "Oh, it's all nonsense. It's all just rubbish. It's just people just getting pissed and walking home, just making up stories or whatever." I managed to speak to them both individually, separately at one point, and it turned out that this loudmouth had actually seen it, but he just didn't want to accept, I think, that he had seen something beyond, if you know what I mean, of rationale. And he was just like, "Yeah, I was just pissed" or whatever, which I thought was really fascinating. He must have been in his 70s or 80s. They were both like pretty hardened laborers in their time, I guess, working on the farm. I just don't think he wanted to accept what he had seen. This does happen when people see stuff that does fundamentally shake their kind of view on reality, which I get. And there is, I mean, just to, you know, go forward on that, there has been this lady that I've spoken with recently who saw it when she was a kid. She grew up in Ruffham. And she said she saw it with two other friends, but her two other friends denied ever seeing it and refused to kind of believe it, which is,
So they saw it at the same time, the three people, three girls.
Yeah, they saw it at the same time. I think, if I remember correctly, she said that they were 10 years old and they were biking about. And obviously they know their village really well and they knew that that house wasn't there, if you know what I mean. So they saw this beautiful house. But it shocked her to her core. She was quite cagey about talking to me about it because obviously it was a very distressing experience for her. We've all got our own fixed versions of how we operate in day-to-day life, and if something shatters that, it is a horrible experience. And I think that's part of the attraction to paranormal activity, or with this case in particular, because it is so unique and strange, and it does kind of make us question what is reality? What's going on?
If I saw something like that, I'd certainly be questioning my own sanity, first of all. And then, I mean, that would be the first thing you would think about, wouldn't it? That's right. it was just a remarkable place. It really was. We ventured into the grove. It's known as Colville's Grove, isn't it? It's basically a you know, tree-lined area, but it's we ventured in there and we found a couple of we found the bones of a couple of dead badgers, I think. And nothing really jumped out and grabbed us by the foot, but it's certainly, you know, like you aforementioned, it's not the kind of place you'd want to hang out at night time, is it?
No.
Just harking back to theories, we spoke about Carl Grove's theory about the time slip, and there was kind of something I brought up with you, and I remember being savagely shot down, and you retorting my my view and saying no, there's no way it can be a time slip, and you had another theory about what could be going on there.
Well, I shot down my own theory recently as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the time slip phenomena, it's just from my initial research with like reading other cases, it's, you know, it tends to be people on foot for some reason. Well, these are the ones in the UK anyway that I've researched.
Because there's actually... Sorry to interrupt. There's actually one close by to Ruffham, a famous case in a town called Kersey, which fortunately I was scheduled to visit, but due to some logistical issues, I couldn't get there. But it's actually in fairly close proximity to Ruffham, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it's not too far away. And I mean, just a bit of there was a family outing in the village, and they then, you know, saw a kind of horse and cart go by, and then the whole village just transformed to like 100 or 200 years in the past for a couple of minutes it was, and then it kind of faded away. And there's another case, I think it's Lowestoft or Great Yarmouth, I can't remember, but yeah, people went into a shop buy some tools, and it was like a really eerily old school shop.
Yeah.
You know, they were kind of like, you know, ringing the bell to see if anyone would come. And I think they did, and they spoke to someone, and they were like, no, we don't have that, and they left. I think when they returned back to Lowestoft or Great Yarmouth, that shop was just completely derelict, like it didn't really exist. There's the famous one in Liverpool. I think you've heard of that. The guy running away from the security guard.
The shoplifter incident, yes. Because that's relatively new, isn't it, that one?
Yeah. I think that's in the last 20 years it is.
Yeah.
He disappears out of plain sight at the security guards and claims to have like transported to a different time of Liverpool and was kind of lost. So yeah, I mean, bringing that to the Ruffin case, it's kind of hard because when people see it now, they are in a car, and it's, because of like the nature of like the location, it's so remote that there's not any kind of signifiers to other things. So it's just fields and trees.
Right.
So there's nothing else that you can be like, oh, that's from 200 years ago or whenever. Like there's no like street lamps or street signs that disappear, and their kind of car doesn't change. Do you know what I mean? There's no other thing other than just seeing this house.
I do. And Ruffham itself is not a condensed village, is it? It's kind of a group of...
It's so sparse.
There is a pub, but the rest of it's kind of just old farmhouses and other places just scattered around, isn't there?
Yeah, it is. And with all the stories, I think from the people that you've heard from and that I've heard from, and obviously the historical case, is like no one else mentions anything else about something changing. Do you know what I mean? Like there is like not like the road changes to a gravel path or like this hedge moves or like
just the house, isn't it? Right.
It's just the house. I just don't believe that the time slip theory can be used for this one. Unless someone does come forward and, you know, gives a more detailed account about maybe the environment or the atmosphere or something leading up to seeing it, or do you know what I mean? I mean, some people have said they've heard a loud noise, but again, that I just don't think that's time slip.
Did you vaguely recall you mentioning a story? You'll have to clarify because I can't quite remember, but it was something about a vortex was seen in the field where the phenomenon happens. Was it a vortex, some sort of whirlwind, some sort of low rumbling?
Yeah, this was from Phil Sage, the oral historian I mentioned previously. He's never seen the house, but he has interviewed, I think it was Sandra Hardwick, who saw it as a small girl in the village in 1974. That's one of the historical cases. And she became a Met Phil. So he's like on and off been like researching this for decades. But he's never seen the house, but he lives probably about less than a 5-minute walk from the field and the grove. But he was an avid metal detectorist in the 90s and early 2000s. And one day he was metal detecting alongside Colville's wood, the grove. And he said that he heard this really loud noise behind him and he thought it was his metal detector playing out. But it wasn't. So he took his like headphones off and he heard the noise was coming from behind him. It was like this loud, he said like a real strong wind whooshing noise. So he turned around and he saw this kind of, he didn't describe it as a vortex, but I think it definitely is some type of, I don't know, vortex thing. I mean, it's just like, just saying like there was a circle and it was churning up all the dirt and moving towards him, basically.
Wow.
And it was really powerful to the point where it was like he felt it was pulling him into the circle. And then, you know, because it's churning up, I guess, all the rocks and all the dirt and clods and stuff, he said that one of them hit him on the head and he fell over and he's laying on his side and he can just see this kind of circle churning the ground just go into the forest and then just like disappear, like completely fade, not like into the wood, but getting to the boundary of it and then disappearing. And it was just silence. Yeah, I've never heard a story like that in my life.
It's time for another episode of Occam's Razor, a podcast about the unexplained, brought to you on Podcast Radio with your host Jim Bedchill.
And we're back with part two of this fascinating episode of Occam's Razor. My guest is Simon Nunn, who is a documentary filmmaker who is making a feature on the Ruffham, I don't know what to call it anymore. Should we call it the Ruffham Ghost House, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most accurate.
Probably the most accurate.
I hate the term.
What about apparition, Ruffham apparition, something like that?
Yeah, let's go with that.
Good as gold. Anyway, we were talking about Phil Sage and he was him experiencing some sort of vortex, for lack of a better word. We don't really know what happened. And that's a pretty bizarre phenomenon. I did notice when we were in the field, you pointed out the presence of a large power pylon as well. And as we know with things like the stone tape theory, they always point towards an energy source to sort of rev things up spiritually, as it were. What do you make of that? Do you think we're dealing, discounting the time slip sort of thing? Are we talking about parallel dimensions? Are we talking about some sort of replay of the past?
First, he saw this vortex, in the field alongside the wood and it kind of disappeared. And then he told me that he's been to the field with a dowser, like a diviner, and also a fellow metal detectorist. And there was two stories he told me where there was one guy who was metal detecting with him who had a pacemaker. I think he had a dodgy heart anyway. And right. He was metal detecting and he felt some sort of like energy pull go through his metal detector. And he fell over and Phil, went and helped him. And he was like, oh, I'll go to the car, get my pills, his heart pills. Gave him his pills, kind of perked him up a bit, gave him some water. And he just was like, I'm never coming back here. So I just felt this like zap of energy go through the metal detector. And it really scared him, obviously. And then another story he told me was the divining rods. This chap came, I can't remember his name, but if anyone doesn't know, divining rods are these, like, you know, you can just use bloody, what are they called? Cloak hangers.
Sure.
Coat hangers. Bend them, and you can just make these kind of rods, and you can basically find water with them. And actually, people still use them. My partner actually got some fencing done recently, and the fencing guys pulled out some divining rods, and she thought they were joking. And they were like, "No, we still use them." And they found, you know, they found where the water pipes were, so they didn't dig into them. It's pretty nuts. Yeah, so this guy was doing a bit of divining in the field to maybe find a kind of water source for the house or something, and then his rods got snatched away from him, and then they left shortly after that. so, yeah, there's definitely, I mean, people do say there's the ley lines do, you know, the theory of ley lines and this kind of, like, energy currents, and there's something there that is just, like, the kind of, a power source to this kind of activity, because outside of this, you know, the rough ghost house, there's so much activity in the area. But we'll go on, I guess, later on about some other theories and research that I've had recently about that. I can't remember your original question. It's about the pylons, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, incorporating the stone tape theory in there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the stone tape theory, I've been investigating, because obviously it needs to be in, like, on, you know, it's like a traumatic event recorded in a physical object like stone, so, like, finding a house that matches the description in the area, in the field preferably, that's had a traumatic event or something's happened to this house or within this house for it then to replay. There's a lot of ifs and buts there, and I just don't know. The energy pylons is quite interesting because, yeah, there's two massive ones, I think, running through the field. And there could be something in that. I mean, maybe an infrasound being emitted that could possibly explain, like, the strange atmosphere and, I guess, not like anxiety-inducing, but the kind of strange feeling that you get in the wood. But I don't know. I'm not sure. I feel like there is some sort of atmospheric energy. Something is there.
Some sort of super energy highway, you know, like maybe we're talking, maybe we are talking ley lines or similar.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I've done a bit of research into the ley lines in Rougham, and I mean, I don't know how accurate the maps that I was looking at, but they actually run. They don't run through Kingshall Street, which is where people see this house off on the field. It actually runs, weirdly, it runs through Rougham Hall on the 2 miles north, just over the A14, which is a bombed out, not Georgian, Jacobean, I think, Hall. Yeah, it was bombed in World War II. But weirdly, yeah, a ley line runs through there, and then another ley line, I think it's the St. Mary line, runs south of where the Grove is, in Bradfield St. George. I think it runs through the church there, actually, weirdly enough, the one that we visited.
That is completely that is not surprising to me in the slightest. I can't describe how spooked out I was at that place. Well, you were there, you knew, so. It was just just the vibe, man. I know. It was weird. I don't know. It was just because I'd had a strange incident at Temple Church in London, in the Inner Temple, a couple of weeks earlier, and I think I was basically on edge, you know, in terms of what's going to happen to me next on this little sojourn into the paranormal, as it were. So. Yeah, it was a great place to start the trip, isn't it? Anyway, wasn't it? And there has been. I had a report from a fellow email me that there's a ghost of a monk that gets seen quite regularly around Bradfield St. George Church, which leads me into my next little segue here, in the sense that there's a lane there, is it called Angel Lane? That's close by to the grove where monks used to...
I think it's called Gypsy Lane.
Gypsy Lane, is it? Yes. And monks, my understanding is in the olden days, monks used to collect wood that they've harvested from around that area and transport it to the abbey that we mentioned earlier at Bury St. Edmunds. And some spectral monks, which are very popular in the in this realm, have been seen in the area as well.
Yeah, just for some context, Bury St. Edmunds is a fairly small town, but at one point it was excessively big for the town because it was in full swing. They would. Yeah, like you say, there was a route that they would take up to Ruffham, and I think it's Tinker's Wood, which is where Gypsy Lane goes towards, and they would chop wood and bring it to the Abbey. I was reviewing some footage the other day of one of the witnesses who was visited by Phil Sage, and he brought a map to her, and it showed like a little square in the field where she saw. The Ruffham ghost house. And they reckoned it was like some sort of lodge or place where the monks would go to store wood potentially or stay there because it was right near Tinker's Wood.
Right.
But I mean, the case I'm talking about is the Jean Batram one where she actually saw it on the other field opposite. And that would actually correlate to like seeing this potential, I don't know, like structure on a map. But again, it's like, you know, a Georgian house doesn't look like a medieval monk's lodge.
No.
So.
Notwithstanding the fact that all this just sounds, you know, too good to be true. The time periods don't seem to fit either, do they? Which I was just going to mention. You mentioned the sighting across the road. Now, there's a guy, a local guy, you know, he lives there, who picked up some red bricks from inside the grove and ended up using them on a driveway or his own driveway. And people have described a red brick mansion, obviously. Yeah. How much weight do you put into that story?
I was told this by Phil as well, and also a member of the cyclical
the British Cyclical Society, is it?
Yeah, that's the one.
That's right. They don't like me for some reason.
I wonder why.
I don't know. I've approached them a couple of times to people on this show, and I just think. I don't know. I don't have a lot of letters after my name, perhaps. That could be the problem. But, yes. Anyway, moving on.
I spoke to a guy that was somehow connected to the story and to the society. And he had researched it a little bit, I think, in the late 90s or early 2000s. And he had mentioned that story as well as Phil mentioning it to me. I can't remember if it was the farmer. It was someone local like that who, dug up loads of red bricks. And then I think it's the bungalow opposite where it's seen is paved in red bricks, and they are the red bricks used from finding it. I'm not...
That's all anecdotal, though, isn't it? You didn't approach You didn't approach the homeowner or anything, no.
Yeah, I mean, even the current homeowner wouldn't know. They wouldn't know because this would have been a long time ago.
And for Georgian architecture, we're sort of thinking sort of the early 1800s for about 100 years on from then. That sounds about right. So, the UK is pretty old. Obviously, England's an old place. Records are kept. They have been kept for, hundreds of years. Going back to the Magna Carta, probably. But there doesn't seem to be any record of a structure ever being there, is it? That's accurate?
There's nothing on that field or in that woodland. Again, this is anecdotal, but Phil did say that he had a map that showed a kind of like a coat of arms over the grove. I've never seen this map. He couldn't find it when I visited him. I don't think he's found it still. So I don't know if this is just hearsay, but apparently there is a map with a coat of arms on it. But through my research recently, it's kind of led me to King Edmund, which is quite funny.
Barry St. Edmunds, right.
Yeah, it's... So basically, King Edmund... I mean, it's very much disputed where he was kind of killed and buried. I mean, I don't know where he was kind of executed by the Danes. One contender is Bradfield St. Clair, which is very, very close to Ruffham. Right. And it's quite convenient that in Ruffham, where the house has been seen, is Kingshall Street. And there's also a Kingshall Green and I think a Kingshall Farm.
Right.
In the vicinity. So from my research, I have found that there is written evidence from an abbot writing about this, that there was some sort of royal estate in that area, kind of branching from Ruffham to Bradfield St. Clair, which would kind of suggest it is in that Kingshall Street area, and that's where the names come from.
What would be the attraction of royalty in the area? You know, was it hunting lands? What was the background there?
I think it would have been, yeah, like a kind of, not like a retreat, but a place for, you know, to get out of the city. Yeah, maybe go hunting and just kind of, I don't know, wine and dine yourself and enjoy the sights kind of thing. I mean, the abbot doesn't describe the real function of the estate, but it is like mentioned. But that's quite interesting, considering if we think of like maybe stone tape theory, you know, a traumatic event, you know, a beloved king was slaughtered by the Danes. Right. He's a master king in that area. That is a powerful emotional event that could trigger, I don't know, energetic consequences, potentially. I don't know. That's kind of where I'm leading at the moment, is kind of investigating buildings that potentially were there or buildings that do match the description. Because again, like with this King Edmund one, it's like obviously it's a building from the Middle Ages. It's not Georgian. So.
And that's the curio, isn't it, that it doesn't seem none of the time periods, well, the theories in terms that the time periods don't seem to match up, do they? And that's what makes this whole thing even more of a puzzle.
I know. But, I mean, I've been going down a real rabbit hole lately. I'm not sure if this will feature in the film or not. But this is definitely going to feed, because I'm actually also going to write, not a book, but kind of like a report. I think I mentioned this to you.
Yeah.
We could collaborate on that with Carl. But I found evidence that Kingshall Farm, is actually, I mean, it's still there, but it's a newer build. But I found evidence that there was a guy who dug a moat around Kingshall Farm, which is incredibly close to that field. Like, it's literally opposite. Like, I have to show you on a map. Right. And I believe it's a Georgian farmhouse. And that's the only building that kind of matches the description of people seeing it that is close to the area, because currently there is no other Georgian-type building with white columns in front of the house within a mirage range. To speak. Do you know what I mean? There's no house in the area that could be attributed to like it just being a kind of optical illusion.
I remember when we were down at Bradfield's St. George Church, we noticed a couple of red brick Georgian places, didn't we? And we thought, hang on, there's something going on here. But
yeah, we did. I mean, there are Georgian buildings, but they're not.
They certainly weren't as grand, were they? And didn't have the pillars as described.
They weren't. But still not that. Still not that. They need to be closer. I mean, sure. There's a guy that I was going to interview on camera, but it never materialized. But he lived. He lives behind the Methodist Church in Rougham, right. And. He's an avid metal detector, but he told me he found loads of Georgian coins in that field where it's been seen.
Is that right?
Yeah. So I don't know what that means. I mean, that's just more information to add to the mystery. But, yeah.
Well, it's certainly something to piece together, isn't it? And it sounds like you're on the right track. There's still a lot of work to do, obviously. It's I don't know about you. Obviously, you know, because you know you've gone as far as to make a documentary about it. But it's I've just never heard of anything like this. I've heard of phantom aeroplanes and things like that. I always take a interest in Lancaster bombers that get seen around the place in the UK from time to time. Whether they're part of an air show and people are just sort of a bit surprised, I don't know, or whether it's genuine sort of paranormal time slip or whatever phenomena. But this is just one out of the box, the Rougham House. You were mentioning before we went on air that your next step was to get someone with psychic abilities, an empath, something like that, into the field, adjacent to the grove or into the grove. And, you know, see where that route takes you. So what have you got organized there?
So that's happening this Sunday. So this is a guy that I spoke with last year that we tried to do it then, but it just never materialized. But we're meeting up this Sunday. So he's a local psychic. I think he only does one-to-ones for people that, you know, have lost loved ones or want to talk to. But I spoke to him last year about this and he was really interested. And I guess, you know, he's a sensitive person. He can pick up on energies and traumatic events or kind of, you know, paranormal, currents.
Yep.
But yeah, so I'm going to take him to the field where the house has been seen and into the grove, and we're going to see what he can pick up, if anything. Or he'll just be like, nah, this is a load of bollocks, mate. There's nothing here. But no, I think that would be interesting to bring in different people who have different abilities and different angles to kind of give their, their view and their kind of expertise on it.
Yeah.
I didn't tell you this, actually. There was one point I spoke to an archaeologist in Bury, who I'm actually going to get in touch with again to see if he will actually still do it. But he's got a kind of 3D mapping machine that they can see underground.
Oh, the ground penetrating radar.
That's it.
Yeah.
Use that in the grove and on the field, and then we'll find out if there's any foundations of a house that exists there.
You'll have Tony Robinson there next. Digging it up, aren't you?
Yeah, I hope so.
That's right.
Well, I don't think he'll be into that.
No. He's a bit too posh now, I think. Well, that's fascinating, as always, Simon, speaking with you. And how's the progress on the documentary going? It sounds like you've still got a few people to interview and include some new theories and new avenues of investigation. So when will we likely to see that?
This is like a really... it's been a long battle. It's been 3 years I've started this project. I thought I was close to the end of it, but now I feel like I've only just begun again. I was hoping to finish it by the end of this year. I'm still going to, I think, film a few more segments and interviews, like I say, the psychic and potentially some other people. But yeah, I think if not the end of the year by spring in the new year, it'll be done. But yeah, it's taken form. I've got about a 20-minute edit that I'm working with at the moment, but there's just too much. There's too much information and context to just pummel it in. So yeah, I just want to take my time with it.
I mean, there's no point rushing it if you're still getting.
Exactly. Yeah, and like, you still know, getting info. Meeting you and getting in touch with you and hearing there's still like new people out there that have seen it. And I don't know if you mentioned about the academic previously, but she saw it in 2018, which is like the latest reported case. I mean, before that, it was Jean Batram, who saw it in 2007, I believe. So this is like the most recent sighting of it, which is fascinating. Mad.
What's been the time between sightings on average? You know, this, you spoke about 2018 being the most recent. There was sort of 10, 11 years earlier was Jean Batram's account. What about before that?
Well, I've actually been like, yesterday I was actually trying to do like a timeline for it. So the historical cases, which are widely available, I think it jumps from, 1860 was the first one by a farmer called Palfrey. And then I think it jumps to about 1908 or 1914 there was some guy in the village that heard the story and he apparently saw it with a butcher. I think in 1914. Then it jumps to the 1940s, where a couple of people were out working, distributing, they're like a tailored suit company distributing like magazines or something in the village, and they saw it. But then from there, it jumps to, oh, sorry, I'm missing one. It's 1924 is the famous one. Yeah. Of the school teacher who writes into the BBC.
Right.
Have you read about that one?
Yes. Carl stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So then the 1940s, and then it jumps to 1974, which is the Sandra Hardwick case. And I don't know if this is worth mentioning, but she actually said it was thatched, roofed. And I believe that actually I've heard contradictory accounts from her through Phil, where actually she said she saw a large house that was thatch roofed with roses in the garden and there were like glowing windows, but she said it looked like a really pleasant house. But that doesn't relate to the kind of other accounts really. So I think that's worth mentioning. But then after her, it jumps to Jean in 2007. So it's quite sporadic. But through me and you, I think we've managed to kind of piece together a bit more. I mean, you spoke to a gentleman who saw it in the 1980s.
Yeah, that was Tony. Right.
Yeah, Tony. And I've spoken to a lady recently who saw it in the 90s, I think 95.
I mean, those stories are probably out there, aren't they? We're just scratching the surface, and obviously they're starting to come out of the woodwork a bit, so.
Well, yeah, and I found a book recently that I don't know how Carl didn't see it, because you can actually just, you know, read it on Google. But it mentions a account from the 1980s of a lady, which is kind of unreported in the realm of the Rough and Mirage mystery. So I've kind of tied that in. And then it's Jean Batram. And then after that, I spoke to a guy who coincidentally turns out to be the grandson of this chap who saw on the gypsy camp, who saw the house twice. He saw it when he was, I think he said it was 15 or 16, cycling home from work. And he said he knows the road off by heart. He's cycled down it a million times. And this one evening, cycling home from work, he saw this giant house in the field, and it just scared the living shit out of him, and he just cycled home and told his family.
because he knew it wasn't supposed to be there.
Yeah, he knew it wasn't that it wasn't real, but obviously. But he did describe the white columns at the front, Georgian style. But that was 2009, 2010, that would have been. So that is after Gene. Then obviously after that, it's the academic lady. And yeah, like you said, it's got to be more and more out there. And I think, I mean, if we did like a radio show appearance or a newspaper call out every year, we'd get more and more people that have claimed to have seen it.
Well, it's a remarkable number of people that's seen it, given the just the population of the area, isn't it?
Yeah, and they don't. It's, like I said, I think 89% of them didn't know the story, don't know each other. I think most of them aren't from Ruffin either as well. No. A lot of them are just passing through. Who's that guy that you spoke with? Is it Tom Hunt? He's saying that he's
Tom. Retold the story about an American couple who saw it, which obviously when two people see it at the same time lends a lot of credence to things. So I'm actually going to catch up with him and just record him for another project. So that's coming up. But yeah, anytime you get multiple witnesses on something like this, it's a different dimension, isn't it? No pun intended.
Yeah, I mean that's really interesting, because I think like you say, a couple of witnesses or a couple of Americans who weren't from the area, and then reporting it back to his dad, being like, "Oh, who owns that gorgeous, like, exuberant house down the road?" Just like, it doesn't exist now.
Oh, that's brilliant, Simon. Thanks for coming on Occam's Razor for the first time ever. I'm sure we'll have you on the show again. Simon has been talking about the Ruffin, we're going to call it the ghost house now, for lack of a better term. And I think we'll hear a lot more about it. And we look forward to your documentary.
Thanks very much, Jim. It's been a pleasure.